Hello and welcome to this week's Standing With Refugees podcast, and thank you for joining us. I'm Paul Hutchings, one of the founders of Refugee Support Europe, and this week I'm talking to Joy Stacey, who's the founder of SILAT Network. Hello, Joy.
Hi, Paul.
Thanks for talking to us. SILAT Network, can you tell me, where's that name come from and what is it that you do?
So SILAT Network, I'm in the process of setting up. SILAT means, it's Arabic, it means to constantly be connecting and joining. And it's a network providing training and mentorship to students in refugee communities and in countries with large refugee populations, and also countries with conflict spaces, to help them find access to education abroad.
Mm. And when you say education, we were talking about this earlier, it's mostly tertiary education. We're talking about degrees, is that right?
Yeah, higher education. Spaces where there are scholarships available. Some scholarships are over-applied for, but a lot of scholarships are totally under-applied for. So it's trying to also draw attention to those scholarships that could help people have a chance to gain an education and then bring that back to their communities to benefit their families, or in some cases move abroad permanently.
I guess in an era of austerity, my first thought is that there aren't that many scholarships out there for people to do education.
No, it's very competitive, but there's a mix. I mean, there are some scholarships that are, such as the British Council or Chevening, which are obviously very, very large scholarships that are very, very competitive, massively over applied for. I'm a PhD student at Sussex, and I've had staff at Sussex encourage me to get friends to apply to some of their scholarships because people aren't aware that they exist. And I think one of the problems is university websites are very obtuse. They're very difficult to navigate. Mm. So people don't always realise that there are scholarships available when there are some really great ones available I work specifically in Palestine and Lebanon, and that's where I'm setting up SILAT with the intention of expanding further, but that's my base. And there are definitely scholarships people are unaware of.
Mm. And so there are scholarships available for refugees who are in Lebanon and Palestine?
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you start off working there, and what was it like working there?
Well, first time I went to Palestine, I was 21. I was quite naive. I had this idea I wanted to be a photojournalist, which I learned very quickly was not my field. Right. But I made friends, and so I kept going back. And through the course of my own education, more and more people started coming to me for advice on applications, and I ended up working with a number of my friends to the point where I had to run a workshop last year to test run whether it had border appeal. And we advertised it on Facebook 5 days before. It was a very kind of DIY thing, me and some friends in Ramallah. And we had 30 people attending and 200 people watching online.
Wow.
On the live stream. So it very quickly turned what was a casual arrangement between me and my friends into something that is going to be a much bigger structure.
Yeah. And Lebanon as well.
In Lebanon, I've been working in more recently. I spent 6 months there this year. Mm. And the education challenges are very much the same. The refugee situation is much more complex. Mm. In the West Bank, the refugees are all primarily 1948 and 1967 displaced Palestinians. And I work primarily within the West Bank, so well, some people are in the camps and some people are not in the camps. The communities aren't wildly different from one another. Whereas in Lebanon, you have Palestinian refugees, then you have both Gulf Wars, you have Lebanese refugees from the south who were displaced during the war, you have Syrians, you have Armenians, and also there's domestic workers as well who move there for economic reasons and end up living in refugee camps. So you have a very much more complex and diverse setup in Lebanon.
Yeah, so I hear all of that in terms of the different people living in refugee camps, and as I'm sure lots of people listening know, Lebanon has got an enormous number of refugees, particularly relative to its own population. It's what, one in three, something?
Yeah, around that. No one's ever entirely sure because there's a few problems with Lebanon in that currently they're trying to relocate Syrians back to Syria. There's never really a census on who is where. Nobody really monitors the camps. A lot of the camps are ruled by political parties like Hezbollah, which means it's a very fractured country at the best of times, and it's got an enormous people trafficking problem. So in terms of how many refugees there actually are, it's very difficult to say.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a whole podcast on the problems of refugee camps in Lebanon, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, being English, there's only really one camp that was safe for me to go in without going in with an organisation, because all the camps were established in 1948, and as a result of the Palestinians being driven out of Palestine, then became Israel. And that was a result of the British army leaving Palestine and Israel being established, so there was a lot of animosity towards the British in the camps. So Sabra and Shatila, which is in the south of Beirut, is really the one place that's safe to go into independently.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that more actually, but as we were talking there, one of the things that jumped out at me was you said the camp since 1948, and I mean, this is one of the sad facts about refugee camps is they, to my mind, should only be temporary places for people to find some temporary refuge before they can go on and rebuild their lives. But 1948 is 70 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. And the camps were built theoretically under UN models, which means that they were designed to never be permanent. They were designed to not have an infrastructure, to make sure people didn't build schools and shops and facilities. And of course, people do build schools and shops and facilities now, but there's a lot of debate about where the legalities are on that. And it depends on who's running the camps. So in the West Bank, the camps are, they're run by the UN, but they're ruled by the Palestinian Authority generally, with obvious Israeli interventions.
Sure. Which
are far more regular than they should be. Well, they shouldn't be at all.
Yeah.
and then
subject of another podcast.
Yes, there. Absolutely. And then in Lebanon, there's different political factions rule different camps and can lead to all sorts of levels of corruption, unfortunately, which means that the permanent infrastructures are, in my experience, there's significantly less infrastructure in Lebanese refugee camps than there are in the West Bank camps, even though the West Camp, I wouldn't wish either camp on anyone.
No.
Yeah.
No, a refugee camp's nowhere for people to be at all, really, are they? No. But you're going to be providing mentorship and support for people who want to get into doing a degree?
Yes.
In another country?
Yes. So in terms of studying within the country that people are living within, it can be very difficult. There's a lot of racism within the institutions, so refugees are regularly discriminated against, particularly in Lebanon. And in terms of being able to pay for the study, that's not always an option, very rarely an option. There's very few scholarships available in those universities, and a lot of refugees aren't even allowed to work at all. So their families can't support them in that. There's no scholarships available. Go abroad and suddenly there's a whole lot more available to them. And also, in some circumstances, an escape from the kind of institutionalised racism against refugees. So it can make all the difference with them getting education abroad. It means that they can bring that back to their communities, or they can find a way for their families to leave the country. Particularly in the case of Syrians living in Lebanon, there is no future for Syrians living in Lebanon. So moving abroad at the moment is definitely the best option for them. It's a way of putting opportunities in the hands of people that totally deserve it. The way I look at it is so the service I'll be providing will be pairing PhD students in the UK with students who are applying to study abroad, so it's peer-to-peer sharing of knowledge. It's a sharing between equals, so that the knowledge of how to apply to universities abroad is again quite obtuse. In developing countries, it's something that's sold to students who can afford it. So consultants will quite often work with students to do these things.
Do you have an idea of how much they might charge?
You know, I have not looked into it particularly, but I do know that there are organisations that have made millions off the back of it in developing countries.
But it's a level that's unaffordable for lots of refugees.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Also, it's knowledge that is available for free to British students, to European students, to American students. So why is it not free to refugees?
It's free through...
through schools, through universities. It's institutionalised forms of bureaucracy, essentially, which we're brought up with, which are not necessarily... Things like CVs were only introduced into Palestinian businesses in the last decade, which means there's a lot of people writing absolutely terrible CVs who are very capable, very intelligent, very qualified, and the way that they write their applications is it does not represent that.
Right.
So it's just trying to make a break from that privileged knowledge, make that freely available to everybody, and then provide mentorship on top of that. So that there's a one-on-one communication with a British student who can go through the drafts with them, make sure that they've got their English on point, make sure their argument's on point, trying to avoid as well the need to display one's trauma. Because I think a lot of students are under the impression, which has to come from somewhere, that they're supposed to display their trauma in order to get a scholarship.
What, sympathy vote?
Yes, exactly. And I think that that is absolutely horrendous. I don't think anyone should be expected to share that on a platform in education. I think that's absolutely irrelevant to whether someone is a good student. And so part of that as well is to try and get students to identify their strengths and focus on that rather than looking back on traumas.
Is it mostly for, I mean, is the service, are you pairing people for studying in the UK?
It will be, so it's going to be a slow build. So we're starting with the UK and US, just because that's where we currently have the expertise, but hoping very quickly to broaden out into European countries as well.
And so in the UK then, because partly there's getting the place and the funding at university, partly there's dealing with the Home Office and immigration, right?
Yes. Yes.
That's another barrier, isn't it? Or not?
It is, but that's something that the universities actually help students with. There are departments within universities already that are there to help students. Once a student has a place at a university and they have their funding in place, there are people at universities that can deal with that. So as much as it is something, in the long run, it's something I definitely want to find a way to be more supportive to students within. I've got to start within my means and I've got to start within my expertise. So that's where it is currently. But in the long run, definitely things like, so working with helping students with immigration process, helping them acclimatise when they arrive, and also establishing new scholarships, encouraging universities to create new scholarships, trying to find ways even to create scholarships within universities in countries like Palestine and Lebanon themselves, which is actually cheaper if you think about it. If you've got someone who's providing funding from Europe, it's cheaper for them to sponsor a student in the West Bank than it is to pay for them to come to Europe to study. So there's different ways of setting that up, because otherwise, if you've got a large number of students then who have very good applications, there's a limit to how many of them are going to get into these universities and get their scholarships, because realistically they will need scholarships. So new scholarships need to be set up as well. But in the beginning, I'm just focusing on getting people's applications as good as they can be. So giving people, there'll be open source training on the website, and then the back end will provide them the one-on-one mentorship, so sharing between peers.
Love it, great stuff. I mean, I can't help thinking about just the way that the UK and the US have moved recently when it comes to, and probably the whole of Western Europe, in terms of making opportunities available to people who are coming from other countries and refugees as well. Because it's a hostile environment here.
Yes.
And it seems to be more and more hostile in the US.
Well, there's a lot of, in academia at least, I mean, I speak from perspective of being at Sussex University, so I'm very used to kind of left-wing British academia, but I've seen universities and students increasingly trying to take responsibility for the lack of support that is there. And so by setting up a network with this mentorship, by encouraging universities to set up new scholarships, we can somewhat take responsibility for trying to turn the tide on that, I think. And I think it's for everybody that shouts loudly against refugees coming to the UK or coming to Europe or going to America, we need people shouting louder about why they should be coming. And if you've got smart, qualified kids, why should they not come to our universities?
Yeah.
We should be doing everything we can to support that. So I think for me, it's part of a tide against that. Yeah.
And I think the other thing I love about it as well is it is a tide against that, but it's also a service that is trying to help people who could get access but don't, because the system is only geared at the moment for people who've got money.
Yeah, absolutely. It's also, well, it's also a system that is, I mean, it's a bureaucratic nightmare.
And I bet.
Particularly in the UK. I mean, American university websites are a little bit more accessible, but I mean, us Brits have a very particular form of bureaucracy that is totally inaccessible if you're not used to it. So it's part of that is just helping people navigate a different way of working, a different way of operating. And that in turn, you know, even if it doesn't lead to a scholarship, it builds on people's professional skills. It helps them identify what their strengths are. It helps them write about it confidently. It helps them work out how to frame their expertise. So while not every student, we're not vetting students on how talented they are, or how, absolutely not. It's an opportunity for students to build their best application, not for us to decide for them whether or not they're good enough for that. So for students that don't necessarily go through the process, the whole process is designed that it will build their professional skills at the same time.
How will they find out about the service?
Well, okay, so Palestine, everybody's on Facebook constantly, and I also have a very large network of people who I can work with alongside that. In Lebanon, I'm working with the UK Lebanon Tech Hub, so they're going to be helping me launch there. Then in the UK, in terms of the universities, I am working alongside Chase Consortium, which is an Arts and Humanities Research Council consortium. And so I'll be working with UK universities directly on this end. But the whole thing is designed as an online platform as well, so that allows me some fluidity between the different communities that I'm working within.
I mean, you mentioned there the advantages. I mean, it seems to me it speaks for itself, the advantage of getting a university education. There's improved prospects, you know, better opportunities, probably better quality of life, lots of different advantages there. But for the UK and US universities, what are the advantages there from taking more refugees from places like Lebanon and Palestine?
well, these universities should be taking the best students, shouldn't they, in order to be the best universities. And if at the moment the only, well, no, not obviously, there are wonderfully talented refugees who are coming to the UK, US and Europe already. But if some of those kids are kids that have paid their way to that point and there are more talented kids that could be coming, those more talented kids should be coming. Mm. And also in terms of like the diversity of students, I think that's hugely important. You know, I'm about to start lecturing myself and I'm delighted with the fact that we've got students coming from countries all over the world. It's also a huge part of the economy of our universities. They're built on students coming from abroad. Mm. And at the moment, you know, the UK academy itself is massively under threat. Mm. It's being hugely undermined by the austerity cuts. And we need to maintain our reputation as one of the best countries in the world for universities. And if we've got the best students coming, that's wonderful. Mm. Particularly if they are able to share different perspectives, different points of view, different experiences of life. We need students coming from everywhere.
Mm. Have you got an example of someone that you've helped?
Yeah, absolutely. So my kind of go-to story is my friend Agnes, who is, she's wildly intelligent, spoke three languages before she was 18. Mm. And when she got to applying for university, she knew she wanted to study in the States. So we spent quite some time together going through different universities, different options, different scholarships. And we went through several drafts of her application together. And her first draft, it was great. I mean, it represented her, represented her situation, but it was more descriptive of a scenario she'd been in than it was descriptive of who she was as a student and what she was capable of as a student. And honestly, this is someone that has held me to account on my own studies since she was 12. She's very, very smart. So all I did in the end really was just kind of went through and I talked her through the process, the administrative process, but I also kind of asked the right questions. What makes you specifically as a student unique? What is it that the circumstances that you are describing in your application, what has that brought to your education? What does that mean in terms of what actions you're going to take next? What does that motivate you to do? Mm. And can you articulate that in a A4 side, which is obviously a very difficult thing to do. But in the end, we went through it and it was all her words, her work, but I was just there sort of prompting a little bit. Mm. And she, in the end, she got $250,000 for 4 years of study in the United States with accommodation, living costs, everything. It was extraordinary. It was a huge amount of money.
Isn't it?
And she's studying international relations and languages, and quite honestly, I can see her ruling the world one day. She's a really, really extraordinary woman.
A good investment in Agnes, then.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I can't wait to see where that takes her. And I think it's situations like that that have made me want to carry on as well, because I've met so many people like Agnes, so many people who are so smart and so passionate and so competent, and they just need that little bit of help to kind of work their way through the system in order to get what they absolutely have earned off their own backs.
Yeah, it's such an important message. How can people find out more about what you're doing?
Okay, so well, as I said, I'm in the seed funding stage, so they're not quite online just yet, but I have an email address set up, which is joy@silatnetwork. So it's silatnetwork, S-I-L-A-T, so joy@silatnetwork.com.
Yeah.
And the website will hopefully be going online early next year.
Great.
Any support, any contacts, any funding opportunities, I would be very grateful. Mm. At the moment, it's just me running the organisation, and I'm hoping to branch it out so I can have colleagues working in the different countries we're establishing ourselves in.
Yeah, I mean, funding is always one of those ones that's important, and I guess getting core funding to pay for the infrastructure is one of the hardest things to get.
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing is, as a digital platform, it is extremely low running cost,
sure,
with the potential for extremely high impact. Mm. And the fact that it's so easy to then launch the same project in different countries, I think makes it a huge advantage. So, yeah, I've very deliberately designed it to be as low running cost as possible.
Mm. So financial support is helpful, but what other kind of support are you looking for? What else do you need?
Contacts within universities, definitely. People who are used to recruiting students to universities, people who have experience in other countries with refugee populations who can help me understand the needs in those countries specifically. It is something I want to continue to grow. Also, once the website is online, it's going to be really important that people know that there is open source training there. Mm. You know, we're going to have YouTube videos, we're going to have tutorials, we're going to have a lot of information about how people can go through the process of applications. And it's stuff that people normally charge money for. And I think that that's a really corrupt system. I think that there's something fundamentally wrong with that knowledge being privileged.
Yeah.
So for me, there's a bit of delight in disrupting the system and allowing that to be something that people can use for free.
Yeah, I love that. It feels subversive, and that's a great thing.
Yeah. I mean, as subversive as education training can be, but yeah.
It's challenging power, and that's a great thing.
Yes.
And I mean, the other thing as well is, you know, anything that can get people out of refugee camps has got to be a good thing. It's a frequent frustration of mine that I see incredibly talented people just languishing in a camp without the opportunities to take advantage of what they do have. And I just think there's so many people in these camps who just need to be given the opportunity to get started somewhere. They'll flourish.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the reason I ended up really continuing to work in Palestine the way I did was because I was surrounded by so many incredibly talented, passionate, proactive young people, and we've kind of all grown up alongside each other.
Mm.
And you know, they make me feel lazy. and it gives me energy to work. It's amazing. I mean, people that are faced with the worst challenges really do work the hardest.
Mm.
And I think they deserve every opportunity. I really do.
Mm. Well, I think it's fantastic. Thank you, Joy, for standing with refugees. And thank you to everyone for listening.
Thank you very much.
We try to talk to someone every week and make it available to download on Mondays. Usually you can subscribe on Podbean and iTunes, download, find it on our website. Please tell us what you think by email. We're also on Facebook. Do a search and you'll find us. Twitter, Instagram, all the usual channels. And if you have any suggestions about who we can talk to, please let us know.
Thank you very much.